Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey Griefsters, please excuse my very husky voice. I actually lost it completely on Sunday and sounded like a 13-year-old boy going through some very serious puberty, so it's quite exciting I can actually speak to you now. I hope you're having an okay week, and the dark isn't getting to you. The dark's getting to me, guys. I don't know if I'm the only one. And also the early Christmas. Christmas can be a bit tricky, and I don't know about you, but my social media is full of people just putting up their Christmas trees. It's a bit much. I'm going to wait. I'm going to try and hold off because I want something to look forward to. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show as ever, please do rate and review on iTunes. I was looking at some of the reviews this week and I was very, very touched by them. You've written some very lovely things. So thank you if you've already done that. I genuinely, genuinely appreciate it because it is hard to do this show every week. So it's very nice to know that it's helping in any shape or form at all. Thank you, basically. This week's guest is a very exciting one. This week I'm talking to Annika Rice. Annika fucking Rice, guys. I'm a big fan of Annika Rice, as you'll hear. I think she's an amazing lady, and I was very excited that she agreed to come and talk to me. This week we kind of talk a lot about grief in general. We do touch on the loss of Annika's friend who died when she was in her 30s, but we also just talk about grief and how you get through it, and anxiety and depression and all sorts of different things. And I very much hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with broadcaster, writer and painter, and frankly, she doesn't really need an introduction. It's Annika Rice, everybody.
Hello, Carriad.
I'm so excited you're here.
Well, I'm pretty excited to be here, because last time we met was on a Radio 4 panel show.
Yes, we did a Radio 4.
Where we did a bit of banter and a bit of chat, touched on a bit of death, and here I am.
Yes, that's interesting, because we were doing a comedy show, but there was sort of a question about grief and death, I think probably because I was on, but they didn't ask me, they asked you, and you were so eloquent about death, and I was like, I'm going to ask Annika to do the show. Annika, we have to talk about grief. There's like so much I want to ask you, because I hope this isn't offensive, I grew up watching you, thinking, I love to challenge Annika. so much, as I'm sure many of our listeners did. And I want to ask you, how did you get that job? Like, what happened?
Well, challenge, because it was my format. I devised the whole format.
Wow.
Because I'd started my career in news and current affairs.
Okay.
That was my training. I trained at the BBC and then went and worked as a broadcaster in Hong Kong, reading the news,
wow,
sub-editing the news at a very young age.
Yeah.
This is all before I'm 22, literally. And when I came back to the UK after this, you know, quite solid bank of work and, you know, an arc that was definitely going in a sort of more
journalistic, serious
way, writing or whatever, I worked as a reporter at Thames Television. And then this audition for this mad program called Treasure Hunt came up, and someone heard I was running a marathon and said, you should audition for it. And it was so far out of my remit of what I was doing. I did it as a sort of slight piss take,
yeah.
And I ended up in Hyde Park with all these butch men who were being auditioned at the same time. There was sort of Daley Thompson, a lot of famous athletes, and me, and I was the only girl. Anyway, we had to sort of charge around Hyde Park, for, you know, looking at a map and grid references and things. And I just had a laugh with the cameraman, and afterwards I heard the cameraman actually say to the producer, go for Annie, you know, she's a laugh, and also she's the only one I can keep up with.
Wow.
So I got catapulted into a completely different career, which I still didn't take very seriously until the first day of that broadcast, where I was on the front page of every paper, and my whole life became a different life overnight. It was the most weird thing. Anyway, I did a few years of that and endless different shows. It was a hugely sort of successful, from a career point of view, part of my life. And I was working on all these projects and thinking, they're great, I'm enjoying them. You know, what's not to like about being in Bali, flying in a helicopter?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that bit of telly is on Channel 4 for an hour and then it's gone.
Yeah.
Honestly, who cares? People have enjoyed it. But what if one could devise a programme, use all that programme budget to go into something where at the end of the programme, everyone went, I do care and I can carry on caring because there's something left behind.
And it's an amazing idea. And it literally is a brilliant idea.
I just used it as a way of harnessing the power of telly so that you could use your... We had a slot on for Challenge Annika on Saturday night at 7 o'clock.
Wow.
Amazing slot. It was essentially a light entertainment programme that we delivered, but actually it wasn't.
It was
an extraordinary programme where things got done and we highlighted a lot of quite important issues. But because it was fun and we had the buggy and the lorry and Dave the Sound Man and a puppy sometimes and God knows what.
Yeah, you saw, they call that, there's a phrase for it now called like Trojan horse programming. So it's like how you get something more meaningful past like a commissioner. So there's a show called Atlanta, which was devised by... Donald Glover, who's this amazing American black actor. And they sort of pitched it as like, oh, it's just this like, you know, fun comedy. But actually, it's like a massive critique on racism in America. So it's like this idea of like, it's just fun, guys, it's
honestly,
fun.
Honestly, it's a laugh.
Yeah, but like underneath. And you're right, Challenge Annika really, I remember watching as a child, and like we were just talking about the Romanian episode and the orphanage and things that I was like, wow, I didn't know that was happening. But you're just watching it with your family on a Saturday night.
The amazing thing was we highlighted so many issues that, this is 25 years ago now, so we did homelessness, we did single mums, all sorts of, you know, disability was a massive thing.
Yeah, I remember
we covered
that, like
a lot.
Trying to get things accessible before a time
we,
that...
we did halfway houses for spinal injury units so that people coming out of hospital could go and learn how to...
Wow.
Learn their life again in a wheelchair. We did the first commercial for the Paralympic Association at a time when no one even knew what the Paralympics was.
Yeah.
I mean, what? Someone in a wheelchair does sport? Don't be stupid. You know what? You've got one arm and you can swim. Get off it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And we made this amazing commercial that was shown in cinemas. And we did it in 2 days with Tom Conti doing a great voiceover with the tagline, don't let your disability get in the way of your ability. And it just showed people, blind, whatever, you know, all sorts of disabilities doing extraordinary things in a sports environment. at a time when we just didn't know anything about it. And so if you look at 25 years on, how amazing now, because now it is so mainstream. We absolutely know what that word means, Paralympian.
And there's a respect for it.
Real
and
respect.
It's not confusion.
There's funds, you know, and everything. But so in a way, a lot of these projects we did, like Riding for the Disabled, or, you know, they've all just changed, you know. On the whole, things have got better. It's a very lovely program to have done. You know, it's been my life's work, really.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's all I've done, really.
I think you are amazing. I really do, because I think it was like I remember watching it so vividly. And like you said, it was this a very sneaky program, because you just thought, oh, she's so funny and Dave Sandman's really funny. That's sad. That's bad that's happening. It was like that awareness thing that I was raising. And it's funny because you are so full of life. But here we are talking, well, making you talk about death. So who are we remembering today? Is there someone specific we're remembering today?
Well, do you know, I've felt a lot of grief in my life. I know a lot of people talk about their grandparents or their parents. I'm absolutely fine about death, funnily enough, if people die at the right age.
Mm.
You know, obviously, you know, that there's just a sort of arc of life. But also I think grief isn't necessarily about death or almost. Mm. I think you can carry a lot of grief for a loss, end of a relationship.
There's
so many ways you can carry grief through life. I've got first class honours in grief. I've got a brownie badge and a girl guide badge, whatever other badges.
So what was your first experience of it, like when you were younger?
Well, I had a bit of a troubled childhood, to be honest. I wasn't very happy, always very insecure. So a lot of my restless energy of moving around the world and looking for things is always to do with sort of filling a void, you know. And then in my 20s, I discovered complete happiness when I met my husband. And, you know, I was so happy, so contented, so secure for the first time in my life, because I'd never had security as a child. I just always felt like my rug was being pulled from under my feet.
Which is what we describe as grief. When my dad died, that's how I felt, like someone had done the tablecloth.
Just all the time.
Just
at every day you expect to be caught out.
Yeah.
And that's how I sort of felt as a child, just growing up with my rather dysfunctional family. And then when I suddenly, after I'd worked in Hong Kong, came back to Britain, I just had this extraordinary decade of being utterly contented and utterly happy. And then in my early 30s, my whole world collapsed. And do you know, honestly, I've never moved on from that moment, which sounds pathetic.
And I'm talking to someone whose dad died when she was 15 and she's still talking about it. Yeah. So like, I am not a mover on her either.
No, I'm
so
not
you're
a mover
in good company.
And I'm saying it with a huge smile, because I'm not saying it for any sympathy. I laugh at myself that I am just literally ridiculous the way my life at, say, 31, 32 sort of stopped.
Mm.
And so I have no expectation, haven't since, of to ever feel that security again.
Wow.
It just doesn't occur to me.
What happened?
Oh, well, without going into details, my marriage split up, which was utterly devastating to me for all sorts of reasons. I'm still great friends with my husband, actually, which is really nice, because we, you know, it was a sort of, you know, no blame thing. But it sort of ended for all sorts of complicated reasons. And at the same time, my best friend, my one and only, you know, because I'd had a weird childhood and travelled a lot, I didn't have a lot of bank of friends like people who've been to university or anything like that. I could never go to university. My parents couldn't afford to send me to anything like that. So I just made my own history, if you like. And and my best friend, who I'd known since I was six, who genuinely was that one person, died tragically. And I was with her, you know, up to her death. I was with her body after she died. And so that and my marriage splitting up, I was
that's huge.
Annihilated, because I didn't really have any other points of reference, because at that time, remember, I was so famous. I couldn't go out the front door without usually four or five paparazzi just hovering, because it was in the days where there weren't that many famous people. So if you were one of them, you were really stuffed. I couldn't go anywhere with my little children without outriders following me.
God.
I mean, it sounds so weird to say it now, because I can't You know, obviously now I'm not at all famous, but I really was then. So
yeah, you were. I remember it was. You were huge.
Well, because there weren't that many. There were only sort of four channels. There was no sort of YouTube.
So if you were
there was no internet.
If you were on BBC One on Saturday night, the whole what we all watched you like that was it.
That, all those things happened in a space of a year and a half.
Wow, that's a lot to deal with.
Well. No, it shouldn't be.
No,
but it is for me.
No,
it
I don't think that's for you. I think that's a lot to deal with. I do.
But it was because I didn't have anything else. I didn't have a comforting parents to turn to. I didn't have a bank of old university mates.
Yeah.
I'd been living abroad. I was very famous, so a lot of people felt they couldn't even approach me.
Yeah,
you know, I was
sort
of, and I am quite hermit-like. So my life was very much my husband, the kids, my best friend, and my best friend who died also had kids the same age. So that was my little life.
Yeah.
I was very happy with that little life.
We had Emily Dean on, who's a broadcaster and writer as well, many episodes ago. But and her sister died, and she said something that's really stuck with me, which she said, "I lost my witness." So she said, "I lost my witness to my life."
Yes.
She'd had a really bohemian, crazy upbringing.
Yeah.
And she said, when it...
Oh,
when
that's such a good word.
Yeah.
I really get that.
And she said, when she felt like, you know, she could turn to her sister and go, "God, do you remember that time that, you know, that man playing Doctor Who came around at 1 a.m. and we were made to do a play for our parents?" And her sister would say, "Yeah." And then she said, when you haven't got someone to say, "Do you remember?"
Yeah.
You think you're a bit crazy because did I make that up?
Yes.
And I thought that's a really... Yeah, a really great word of what those people mean to you.
Well, Flea, my friend was that person. Oh. She was a really, we'd sort of known each other since six, and she was my witness to my life and everything.
So was she from the same area then?
Yes, and we'd been to school together. Oh. And then, you know, drifted apart because I was in Hong Kong for 3 years, but was still sort of mate. And then because and she's very organised. She was a very clever sort of stockbroker.
Wow.
And very organised. So when she got pregnant, I thought, "Oh God, it must be time to have a baby." Honestly, I'd have never thought about it. And then she had another one. I thought, "God." So both of my two oldest children are 6 weeks exactly behind hers, because as soon as she got pregnant, I went, "Oh my God, thanks for letting me know."
Yeah, we're supposed to be doing this now.
My
aren't
career
we?
Was so busy.
Yeah,
I barely had
yeah.
time to even know who I was.
God.
So losing that witness, thank you for that, and my marriage breaking up, and so losing my best friend, who also was a witness.
I guess, to your fame and that process, which is a strange process, having, you know, I'm vaguely known in a tiny circle, but I've got friends who are very famous, and watching someone go through that, it is very strange, and especially if you've seen them beforehand. Like you said, when they were a normal person and suddenly people approach them with that strange look in their eye, and you're like, "That's just my friend. Why are you looking them?" Because they start meaning more to them.
So my husband, we'd met just before it all, you
amazing.
Know.
Amazing, yeah, yeah.
And so he was amazed. So the two people who'd sort of just been by my side through that weird process and enabled me just to not be that person. I mean,
to
behind
be grounded,
the front door,
yeah.
we were just a normal family. The weird thing is that the grief that you then carry through life is ceases almost to become about the person. It's just about the memory of that gut-wrenching feel. And because I was trapped behind my front door because of this fame thing.
Yeah, it's such a difficult
and
situation.
And I just, oh God, it was really, it was so such an unhappy part of my life. I just remember pacing up and down the room every day, just like a sort of caged bear, just not knowing what to do. And obviously just flinging myself into the love I had for my children, but not really being able to escape and not having a great bank of friends who all went, "Oh, you poor, you know, we'll come round and here's a shepherd's pie." You know, like you hear of people who leave little parcels on the doorstep.
I just didn't
get that.
And also, like you said, different. It's such a strain. What you're going through is such a specific niche situation.
Yeah. And I couldn't really... Yeah, it was very difficult to even describe to people. And honestly, people would have gone, "Well, get over it. You know, you've only split up with your husband or whatever." But it was just...
I think you're very light about this thing. Like, I think that's huge,
though. No, but as I say, most people... It's perhaps nearly 30 years, Carrie.
Well, people... I'm 20 years in. I'm still talking about it. Like,
no, but most people would have got remarried or replaced it.
I don't know. Like, I think it depends. Like you said, it's because I know I have this. Like, so my dad died 20 years ago, and I'm still talking about it. Whereas if you speak to my brother, obviously similar situation, but he's like, yeah, I don't really feel the need to keep talking about like it happened, and you know his attitude is so different to mine. And I think like you said, I think it depends so much on like fundamentally who you are. And I'm an anxious person, and I think I have a fear of things leaving anyway. And then when my dad did, when that sort of the worst happened, inverted commas, I think it made me almost obsessed with that idea of things going or what happens and how you survive it.
Yes.
And you know, my mum's never remarried, and some people find it surprising, and other people are like, I get
everyone thinks I'm all my friends now, because obviously I don't want to paint this picture that I'm still a pacing bear because I relearned my life. I struggled through for a few more years because I was still filming the challenge program, and then I literally took a sabbatical for 15 years from public life, from work, and went to art school and rebuilt my life, you know, step by step, and have the most wonderful friends now, you know, literally.
Like you said, it takes time. You just have to take time to become friends with people, don't you? So I guess at that point you said you just hadn't had them.
I hadn't had them because I'd just always been travelling and very self-sufficient with my little gang.
Yeah.
And, you know, because my fame came when I was only 22. It's very weird when you're that famous.
That's
people.
So
people
young.
Don't really approach you. Yeah. You know, everyone goes, even if they're at school with you, suddenly you're slightly unapproachable.
Yeah,
they imagine
yeah.
you're sort of sitting in a bath of champagne with several naked men around you, fanning and beating you. Whereas I'm so down to earth that my life hadn't changed at all. I was exactly the same person and still putting out the rubbish and getting up on a stepladder, cleaning out the gutter. But everyone imagined I was unapproachable. So it was a very weird one.
Especially at that time, because it's interesting you talk about celebrity back then, because like you said, there wasn't a lot of celebrities and it was just anyone who was on the telly. That was it. It was one world. And also, like you said, there wasn't access. So because there wasn't social media, people were like the same as they would have been like in the 50s as a starlet. Like, we didn't know what you did, you know, whereas now you've got Insta stories and Twitter. And I can, if I like someone, I can just literally go, oh, I can see their house. I know what they think. And I can almost get bored of them. I can be like, oh, yeah, okay, there they are.
Yeah.
But back then there was still this complete inaccessibility to everybody. Like, yeah, you know, the most we would have seen you is if you'd done through the keyhole. Like, then we would have been like, oh, there's where she lives. But that's like as near as we would have got to somebody.
No,
did you have counselling? Did you go down that road?
I have had, Carrie Ad Lloyd, over nearly 30 years, I've had every kind of therapy you can imagine. Hypnotherapy. I've just wanted to take the fear of it all away. It's not that I've got even an image. I mean, honestly, my husband and I are great mates, but I literally have no urge to be with him.
Yeah, it's not about like unrequited love. It's about something painful happened to
me. It's what it makes me feel, which is this scared. You know, you talk about feeling anxious. I wake up anxious every day. Really?
Yeah, same.
You know, just because I expect something horrid's going to happen the whole time.
Yeah. And how do you, because I'm an anxious person. Like I got literally diagnosed with it a couple of years ago. And when I told my mum, she was like, but we're just worriers. We just worry. Mm. And then the more I read about it, I was like, no, mum, it's a thing. Like, it's a thing. And I remember saying to her once, some people don't wake up worried. And she was like, who? She was like, who are these people?
I love your mum. You see, I wake up black. With a heavy heart, deeply sad every single morning of my life.
Yeah.
Really weirdly. Even if I've no reason to, actually, because I've got gorgeous children. I'm so lucky. Mm. I'm embarrassed. This is a ridiculously embarrassing conversation.
No, but you shouldn't be, because it's about this thing that we don't talk about.
Because maybe people will listen and think, oh, thank goodness I'm not alone. Because actually I feel 100% better hearing that I'm not the only person that wakes up feeling so shit.
Yeah.
Because you're happily married, you've got a child.
Oh, and people look at the same as me. They go, oh, you've got everything. And I remember like...
So do you think we're just... that's just a condition then?
I think it's... Well, this is the more I read about anxiety. It's like, it's a mental health problem.
Yes, but I didn't have it for those blissful years in the middle when I felt secure, you see.
I think
sadness is different from depression.
Yes, that's true. No. It's funny because my therapist is always saying to me, like, I'm obsessed with having no anxiety. Like, that's what I'm looking for, the blissful moment. And I have it very occasionally. There's a blissful moment where there's nothing. And she's always saying to me, that's not real. She's always like, everybody, there is an ordinary level of anxiety. You should, of course, think, oh, I've got to cross the road, or I must pay that bill. And she was like, her theory is like, sometimes people with anxiety, because you live with it all the time, you're like desperately looking for the one, it will never be there. And she's trying to get me to accept, like, a little bit will be there, rather than, you know, how can I get rid of it completely? What can I do? What can I do to feel blissful? She's like, who feels blissful?
Yes.
You know, you have those moments and... You know, that's not, you know, that's as, well, she was saying, it's either the extremes of it. But it's very hard if it's your baseline. That's what I'm always trying to say to her. Like, if your anxiety is 1 to 10, and like a normal person is 1, like, oh, I must remember to do that. I wake up at 6. Like, I mean, I wake up, my level is 6. Yeah. So I don't know what it's like to just be like, oh, I've got a few worries. I don't know what that's like.
It must be so nice just to wake up and be, rather to wake up with baggage somehow.
Yeah.
And it's not even I don't even wake up thinking of something specific.
No, that's what
I mean.
It's just a feeling of dread.
It's my brownie badge. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's sewed into my nightie. So I've got the badge of ridiculous feeling of sadness. I think mine's sadness more than anxiety, even, which I know, therefore, could be curable with the right alchemy of things around. But I honestly, anyone look at my life, and because I'm a very happy, upbeat person, everyone would think, oh, God, she's just so happy and upbeat.
I think that's the kicker, because I have exactly the same thing. And it wasn't until I started doing this podcast that I feel like a lot more people, maybe this is like a weird thing to say, but I felt like certain people, especially my work, understood me better, because I think I come across as very sunny. And I would think, why are they treating me like everything's fine? Because in my head, it's not like that. And it's, again, I wouldn't class myself as depressed, but there's a sadness and a darkness and, you know, there's another side. But I think if you've learned how to hide it, you don't realise how good you've got. That's what I have. Like, I've got very good at being like, yeah, everything's great, everything's fine. But I'm thinking, obviously it's not fine.
But like, I also found it very helpful when I was doing challenge and subsequently with all the post-challenge projects I'm still involved with, is that I find it really helpful to literally put on, to put on that challenge mantle, become
the jumpsuit.
Annika Rise. Take on that persona, because what I do find very good at for alleviating all those symptoms we've just described is I like to put my energies into doing something very constructive, preferably helping someone else, which sounds really corny, but that is what I'm about. I've just realised I'm a dark person, but I have an ability to make things better for other people, which is a sort of, you know, I might as well use that gift or that position I've got, and that is my absolute sort of raison d'etre, you know, and that does make me, that makes me just feel fine. That sort of puts me on baseline.
But I think that's great. It's a great self-awareness to know, okay, well, I have this feeling and it's not, you know, I'm not as happy or I'm feeling sad. How can I use that? And like you said, that's what I have with the anxiety as well. Of like, the anxiety has driven my entire career. Like, it's driven me. And so that's the other complicated thing you have with something, because you go, oh, I don't like it, but also I know it sort of is me and makes me function.
Yes,
so you're trying to balance the two things.
That's I've definitely got a big realisation of that. That's come in the last decade, where I just go, well, that's just me.
That's just me.
I'm a bit weird. I am a bit strange. I'm a bit dark. But let's get on with doing some useful stuff. And as soon as it's a bit like Piglet or Eeyore. Piglet saying, as soon as Piglet was useful, he didn't feel frightened anymore. And that is my mantra.
Yeah.
And as long as I'm being useful and sort of channeling that empathy.
It's also just to accept that there's two sides to everything, of like that feeling produces this sense of justice, which gets, like you said, a, you know, disabled access project in Cornwall up and running, like, but it also can cause that mourning to be hard. Like, nothing is ever black and white, to use a terrible phrase, but like that's it. There's always consequences and positives and negatives of a feeling. We talk about that so much on the show of like grief can destroy you and can be the most painful thing in the world, but it can also get you up and sort you out. Yeah. And that doesn't mean you're glad they died, but there is always a positive, another consequence, really. Yeah. Well, I don't like naming them as positive.
If I was just had a really balanced, jolly life, I don't think I'd have done anything because I'd have been too happy in my huge mansion, which no doubt I'd have had with lakes and the garden and a little rowing boat. I'd just be too busy enjoying whereas I've taken on that role of being like slightly the dark artist in the garret room, suffering. I mean, I quite enjoy it. Let's face it, Karen, I've talked myself into it. I'm bloody loving that.
Yeah, but it's real. And it's, I think, I think you can't, I feel like you can't ignore what you can see. And if you're someone who can see the problems in the world and see the pain, I can't go, well, everything's fine. I can't. I have to, like you said, empathise and understand that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. We should talk about your painting. So have you always been artistic, or did that come after all these griefs?
At school, I didn't even know there was an art room at the school, because I went to quite an old-fashioned school, and you either did chemistry and Latin or you did art and cooking or something.
Wow.
And I never saw the art or the cooking. I'm afraid I was always channeled the other way. I did my O-levels when I was 14. That's why when I joined the BBC on one of their production training courses, very young, 2 years ahead of myself, which is another reason why I think I sort of lost friends along the way, because I was always a bit young for my year. So when you're 11 and you want to run out and play horses in the playground and everyone around you is talking about boyfriends and going for a cigarette, it's difficult to connect.
I feel
I didn't have a lot of school connections really, because I was always a lot younger than everyone else. I remember when I left school feeling hugely elated when I joined the BBC age 17. Because suddenly everyone was different. It was like the feeling I had when I saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show for the first time, aged 15. I thought, this is what the world's about.
Yeah.
Otherness, David Bowie and changes, all those things made you think, oh, yes. Oh, good, that's fine. So once I'd left school, I found this other world of people, all different ages and colours and creeds, because I worked at the World Service. And so you'd go for your lunch at lunchtime in the canteen, and there'd be Indian people in their saris. And my job was booking all the stringers overseas. So I'd go, hello, Delhi, this is London. And it would, I'd speak to Mark Tully, the correspondent from Delhi.
Wow.
So I had a great sense of the world and different things and other things. But I still hadn't discovered anything creative at that stage. And it was only once I'd been working you know, flat out for a few years, that I said to my husband, do you know, all I actually, while concurrently with this mad success all that's happening, I would like to become a Jane Austen heroine and learn to play the piano, or relearn to play the piano, because I had piano lessons, and paint.
Wow.
Perhaps sing. So I did. I did singing lessons
wow.
while I was working.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nick bought me a book called Step by Step Art School and a smock and an easel. And I became obsessed in that way that I am a very obsessive person.
So after that huge grief, did you start painting did your painting, was it helpful to you? Did it become a kind of therapy or?
Well, Once my life had imploded and I'd become the pacing bear, I enrolled at the Chelsea College of Art.
Wow.
Because eventually I just went into the BBC and said, right, I'm giving up work. And they were horrified because obviously I had a very successful Saturday night show.
Yeah.
But I'd done 6 years of challenge. That was over 60 big projects.
Yeah.
So I was always... I'd come back from Romania. The next week I'd be going off to Croatia to work on a project. This was post the Homeland War when there was still, you know, snipers everywhere and it was a very dangerous place to be. And we worked on a school that had been blitzed in the war. And we had the UN protecting us. We had Serb snipers in the hills.
Oh my
you know,
gosh.
Half the time I didn't know whether I was going to get home.
Yeah, yeah.
We worked in a Malawi refugee camp. You know, we worked all over the place. And I just thought, I've done this now for 6 years. And apart from anything else, someone's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
Because we had so many volunteers. And it had gone well. And I always think, quit while you're ahead in a way.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
So everybody's okay.
I went into the BBC and said, I think I'm going to leave it for a while. And they were really good about it.
Wow.
And
that's a huge decision. Because like you said, you were massive.
I don't think a man could have ever done what I did.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
you couldn't. Because I was earning lots of money doing, not doing challenge particularly, but
all the rest
just
of
all
it,
the
yeah,
sort
all
of
the other shows. And if you think about your peers, that idea with the when you are a BBC name, like even after your show stops, you then move, they go and do a game show or they host this and they host that, they're at Children's Eat, and they're sort of still there in your consciousness.
I just dropped out.
You just totally
removed yourself. Completely. I thought it might be for 2 years. It was near on 15.
Wow.
Because I just suddenly found a real contentment in...
In the painting.
In being a mum.
Yeah.
Being just, you know, I'd go off to school in the morning with my kids, basically. We all went off and did our things and came home at tea time and showed each other the pictures we'd done. It was lovely. I found a contentment.
Yeah.
I think that was a very contented period of my life when the children were very little and domestic. I'd never had that really.
But I always think, I'm always interested when people make big decisions like that, because what it screams of to me is a very intense sense of self-preservation, which I think some people don't have. They would just carry on.
Or they're so ruled by financial gain.
Yeah, financial
and
ego.
Fair enough, especially ego.
Yeah.
It's like how... Whereas I genuinely thought that if I stepped out, I'd become unfamous, because that's all I wanted.
Yeah.
I just longed to be able to... You know, I'd go out with Thomas and Josh when they were very little and we'd be in a taxi and get dropped off somewhere and the paparazzi would be waiting for me on the pavement and it freaked me out. How did they know I was going to get there? Honestly, it was like bodyguard. It was the same sort of stress.
Yeah.
How does everyone know where I'm going? So I did really try and become unfamous.
Yeah.
And of course, hilariously, of course, you never do become unfamous.
No, you sort of don't, once you're in that, especially people who are famous before the internet. Like you said, it's a different level of fame, like because
it's everybody knows
everybody
you're
knew,
not just
yeah.
a niche
so like,
YouTube
yeah.
generation gang.
Because now my younger cousin will mention people. I'm like, oh, I don't watch that channel. I haven't seen YouTube. I don't know this.
Yes.
But you know that 80s, 90s fame. It's like, you know, from my mum to my younger cousin, like they know who you are. Like it's a very specific.
Yeah.
We had nothing else to do.
Nothing else to do.
We were
at all.
Watching those four channels very happily.
Yeah.
So the painting as sort of therapy, like.
Well, it's not, except what it does do, Cariad, is, and I've got lots of other people painting, and it is true, doing anything creative is so fills a big, dirty, great hole. You know, it just really fills a void. And it, if I go into my studio and, you know, I sort of pace around it and it's like a sort of wonderful sort of spiritual experience, really. I'm sort of thinking, right, today I'm going to work on that, and I'll sort of walk around it a bit and pace about, and then I'll go into the studio, coffee, radio on, and then I'm in the zone.
Yeah.
And I really am in that zone. So it is, and I totally get why it's therapy or whatever, however you want to get out of it. It is so, and I'm the same when I'm writing, you know, playing the piano, anything, all those Jane Austen things. It's got me through. Just call me Jane.
You would be a great Jane Bennett. I'm just saying that out loud now. Okay. Absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect. But it's interesting, like, so with your grief with your marriage and your friend, did you feel a moment when you were like, oh, I'm coming through this?
No, because shortly after that, I lost two more friends.
Oh,
so I'm
God.
Still in my 30s. And I've, so the other two witnesses, really, to my life also died.
Oh, God, what happened?
Cancer and a brain tumour.
Oh, God.
So it was extraordinary. It was almost, I just thought, oh, my God. And I, funnily enough, when I did Treasure Hunt, Frank, our lovely sound guy, had a very kind of hippie wife who did tarot cards.
Oh, wow.
And she did my tarot cards and she went, oh, my God, the level of success and light and amazement. And then she said, oh, my God, when you're 31. And she, the colour went from her face and she couldn't even discuss it. And I just laughed because, of course, at that point I was all sunny and happy.
God.
But it's so true. It was a shocker of a decade, really, in my 30s. But having said that, I had two amazing children, so
it's ups and downs, but that must have been, that's a lot to deal with, like you said, when you don't have that sort of strong grounding.
I had no strong family to say, can I come home for lunch?
And you look after me.
No.
So how do you think you did get through it? Like what sort of got you through that?
Very slowly.
Decade? Yeah.
Very, very slowly. And no miraculous anything. Obviously, just the love for my family.
Yeah.
And it was just very little. And then through my children and sort of feeling, it was all in my head, I felt I'd become less famous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'd drop them off at school. And instead of sort of rushing back under dark glasses, thinking, everyone, look at me,
yeah,
I would stop and chat, you know. And so I became a different person. I'm much more open, and so I then started,
people came to you,
and I've got a lovely gang of friends.
Did you ever speak at these three funerals? Did you do like eulogies or anything?
I did at two of them.
At two of them. Oh, yeah. How was that?
Well, that's fine because I've got a job to do.
As soon as
I go into, I've spoken at so many funerals.
Oh, really?
Everyone always gives me that job because they know I'll do it.
Yeah.
And I won't cry.
I'll be together.
You know, because that's what I mean about having this very kind of professional Annie and the sort of complete ridiculous other person.
Well, we've talked about a lot on the show. A lot of people we've had on have spoken because that's the thing they know how to do. So it's like if you have a problem with your mortgage, you know, you go to your friend who's good at maths. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't necessarily go to your comedian friend.
Yeah.
But when it comes to public speaking, I think it is something we're all used to. It's not, like, terrifying to us.
Yeah.
And so you do think, well, yeah, I know how to do that. I know how to make my voice stay the same way. I know how to hold the audience. Even though you're sort of like, I didn't expect to use these skills in this situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough, but that sounds like you had a real...
And also friends who... Because I have lost a lot of friends.
Yeah.
I have lost. I mean, another lovely friend of mine, Paul, who died quite recently, asked me to do his eulogy.
So he asked you before he died?
Died,
yeah. Wow.
Because he said, I'm asking because I just know you'll do it beautifully and hold it together.
Because
he just knew I would. It's a weird thing. Do you know what he gave me as a death present? A present in his will. Oh my God, this was amazing because he knows that I'm obsessed with beds and sleep.
Because
I always feel very safe in my bed. If I'm having a dark day, can't wait to get into bed at the end of the day. And so he got me for every bed in the house new mattress toppers, linen, duvets, pillows, you know,
everything,
beautiful thread count sheets and pillowcases.
Present.
What a lovely present.
A death present.
A death present.
So did he buy things for everybody in a kind of like...
No, I think
oh, no, you were special.
I think I got the linen. No, he's quite organised like me, which is, you know, you tend to have friends who are similar. So he thought about it because he had cancer.
Wow.
And that was just what he was going to do. And that's made me... organise my own death a bit.
Yeah, because I want to talk about this. You said this and you must say this. What? Tell us your death plan.
Well,
Annika.
It all started when I used to do the breakfast show on Radio 2 and I always used to talk about death because I just think it's a good idea to talk about death.
Yeah.
I look after, I did, one's died now, but I do a lot of befriending in my local community. So there's three elderly ladies all in their 90s.
Wow.
And I'm sort of, you know, in touch with them to varying degrees. Anyway, one day they all came round to my house for lunch and we sat round and I got out my UE boom, you know, my microphone thing, speaker rather. I put it in the middle of the table and I said, let's all, one by one, go round talking about the favourite pieces of music, perhaps pieces of music you're thinking of having at your funeral.
Oh, wow.
And that sounds weird. I don't know how it...
No, I think it's great.
We built up to it in conversation.
Yeah,
I didn't suddenly say, right, roast chicken and now let's plan your funerals. We built up to it very gently and it was just amazing. My son, who was at school then, my youngest son, came back to see this scene and they're all going, oh, he's rather dishy. Anyway, so he came in and joined in and we just, wow, one by one, I'd say, Stefania, let's start with you. What is your favourite piece of music? And it was all sort of classical.
Yeah.
And, you know, what piece of music would you like to hear at your funeral? And then we put it on. And, of course, they couldn't believe how this music could come out of this speaker that you just put in the middle by the roast potatoes.
It was
a speaker. So that was rather amazing. So we just went round one by one. And then my son, who's a beautiful pianist, played a bit of music for them.
Wow.
So I really felt that was a wonderful day for them.
Yeah.
And it focused their minds and made them, you know, we talked about death for about an hour. And I said, it's so nice to think that your friends will come and they'll all listen to that bit of music.
Yeah.
Anyway, a bit weird.
No, that's not weird at all. I think that's, I think,
I like
what an amazing person you are that you allowed them that experience.
Well, it's an unusual experience but it evolved. I didn't just sit down and say, right, we're now going to do it. We were talking about things. And when you're very old in your 90s, you talk about death quite a bit because it's so near.
But
it's good to speak about it.
Yeah, it's amazing. But to allow those elderly women that space to talk about it, because so many people are frightened. So when it comes up, they shut it down because they're like, you've got plenty of life left in you yet. You'll be all right. And then the doors close.
Let's face it, it's going to be quite soon. Yeah. You're 98. Yeah. There's not going to be many of these left.
But this needs planning, Stefania, and fast.
No. I mean, I talk about it like that.
Yeah.
I'm quite, you know, let's just... Anyway, it was so amazing, but mostly because they didn't know that this speaker could create this huge wall of sound in the kitchen. And so we all sat there with tears running down our cheeks, but in a rather together sisterly way, me and my 90-year-olds. Anyway, back to the Radio 2 breakfast show.
Yeah.
So I often recounted these stories on the breakfast show, talked about my gang that I befriend. And then Carrie Fisher died.
Yeah.
And her coffin was in the shape of a Prozac pill.
Yes.
And I thought, this is the business.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We then started on the radio show this thing about what would you put your ashes in?
Oh, right.
And it became very creative and exciting and everybody was talking about it.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I always said I'd like to, because I'm obsessed with the colour blue, I said I'd like mine mixed up in some blue paint. And I thought maybe even just left in the blue paint with mum written on, you know, three pots for my three sons. And then I took it one step further and thought, no, I'll ask a friend of mine who's an artist to paint three paintings using my ashes.
It's amazing. That's, I think, one of the most beautiful ideas I've heard. Because I think it's so, to do something creative. I know people plant trees, I like that. And sometimes it's made into jewellery, which I kind of like, but I've, what if you're going out somewhere you don't want to wear your dead father? That's my only thought. Yeah. And I just think to have a painting in the person's favourite colour is
yes, I mean, the
so
tree
beautiful.
Or the garden's lovely, but you move house. So
yes,
that, for someone
yeah.
like me, would make me fret.
Yes, because then what happens to your tree?
Tree.
Yeah, I
mean, do you
that.
Have sort of rights to that tree? Visiting rights? Has it?
Yeah.
And at the moment, my dad's on the mantelpiece and my mum's under the snooker table. And there's not a day goes by when I don't fret about I should be doing something with this, and my sister and I go, oh God, we must, you know, this is
yeah,
too many years
yeah.
have gone by now, this is getting out of control. So I thought actually something practical
yeah.
was quite nice. I mean, people do fireworks, don't they?
Yeah, there's things. All sorts, but I think so, there's something very beautiful about one colour and one painting, like being, and that you're, like you said, like your friend's death present. I think knowing that the person made that decision for you
yes.
is very nice. I didn't have a great relationship with my grandmother, but she, about 15 years before she died, split up all her, like, you know, her necklaces, which, you know, they weren't worth anything, but she sort of specifically gave everybody something.
Yes.
And even though we had a very strained relationship, I'm so touched that she decided I would get this one necklace,
yes.
you know.
And so it's much better to deal with it when you're alive.
Yes, I always say
saying,
this, yeah,
out,
definitely,
it?
Always, because... Yeah. The other thing, I think, if you haven't experienced a lot of deaths, then you haven't experienced a lot of the death arguments that happen after someone's died and not been specific.
Mm.
And I think that is one of the most, that's not talked about a lot, actually, is one of the most uglier sides when people start going, well, I wanted that box with the thing on. Well, I said that. Well, she said that. And it
yeah.
gets really, it's really sad because, you know, they're your family, but of course you're going to get into those discussions. So I said to my mum the other day, I was like, you should write down where you want things to go. And she's like, oh, you'll sort it out. And I was like, no. I love my brother, but we can row about literally anything. Like, that's a skill we've been taught, is to row with each other. So I was like, please, because I don't want to have a row about who's going to get that picture, or, you know, even, they're not worth stuff, but
yes.
it's, you know, the sentimentality
yes.
of things. So.
Yes. No, I think it's really good if you can... sort it out.
Yeah, have
front.
A bit of a, if you can, obviously, if you die tragically, you know, it happens over, you know, knocked down by a car. You
but that's
can't,
why it's but, sooner rather than later.
Yeah, definitely. And what do your sons think about that? Are they happy?
They think I'm quite bonkers, but I think they think it's good.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're relieved,
yeah.
to be honest,
yeah.
that they're not going to be left, because they know I archive everything.
Well,
you know, that's
yeah.
one thing they know about me.
They're going to have a big sort
I keep
out.
Everything. I've kept everything from
wow.
their lives, but edited everything. So
yeah.
I've got their best essays when they were seven,
oh,
up to their every tooth. They've
yeah.
I've kept everything
wow.
because I think because I had such a turbulent childhood, I think I obsessively wrote down everything to anchor myself.
Yeah.
I'm convinced of that now as the older person looking back at the younger.
Yeah, yeah.
So desperate to have a. Something that was really solid and reliable
yeah.
that I wrote everything down. I just haven't lost that. I
yeah,
just
well,
haven't
that,
lost that at
you
all.
You learn that, whatever you learn as a child stays with you. And if you learn the fear of that thing, then that becomes, like you said, integral yeah. to your personality.
But they're completely different. They
of
keep
course, yeah.
nothing.
Because they've had you keep everything.
They've had me keep everything.
So they're like, I don't need to keep
but
anything. Mum will keep it.
They can't even, because they're boys, they're not interested in the same way. But the girlfriends
oh, yeah,
love
yeah.
the...
Yeah.
You know, they love the way I can just bring out a little poem
oh.
that one of them wrote age for.
I mean, that is adorable. My mother-in-law kept everything, and, you know, and actually, funny enough, we had to sort through a lot of stuff. And she'd kept, like, his, you know, my husband's an amazing writer, and she'd kept, like, all his, when he was, like, nine, he'd
yes.
written a play and stuff. And even though some of it, he was like, okay, you know, we're going to flow this way. The going through it was quite a nice experience,
yes.
weirdly.
Yes, yes,
the going
yes,
through
yes.
it and having that moment and being like, oh, there's my childhood, there's this person. I was really important to that person at that time and this is why they kept that. And reminding you
yes.
of love, reminding
yes.
you of you were loved. So,
yes, because it's done through love.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
only keeping, you only keep things that utterly show your children off in the most perfect
yeah.
light.
Yeah,
I haven't
yeah,
put
yeah,
in
yeah.
any shoddy essays, can I just say. There's no bad photos.
I burnt all your terrible paintings and believe me, there was a lot of them.
You know, I've edited it
yeah,
as a
yeah.
thing of a work of art for them.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because we live in this world now as well where people say, like, oh, Instagram, you can, like, edit your life and you can make it. But you're right. We've always been doing that. We've always been keeping the best things. Like, we've always thrown away and not told everybody. Like, that's why we're good at doing it on social media, because we've learned how to do it for thousands of years. Of
yes.
like, yeah, I'm not going to read everybody this one. It was bad, but the one I got an A star for.
Yes.
Welcome to the Christmas family sit down. I'm going to tell you my poem. Yeah, that makes sense. And it is all about love. And I suppose, especially because you're an artist, like you said, it becomes a piece. Like,
it's a piece. It's an installation, really.
Yeah,
it is
a
whole sort of thing. It is definitely a thing.
And I think definitely if you've had an insecure childhood, the effect it has on you is it's like I always think like a light going through a prism, you know, like it's like myriad what it does. It's not just like, oh, I'm a bit anxious. It's like, there's so many weird things I do that I think, oh, yeah, that's because I lost someone extremely quickly when I was 15, a pivotal moment. And that, you know, you find yourself doing things thinking, I don't know if you do this, but I get annoyed. I'm like, oh, is it because my dad died? Like every single question of weirdness is like, it's probably
because
my dad
died. Yours is rather lovely because you can link it back to your father, which I think is rather lovely. Mine's just almost self-indulgent because I can't link it back to anything. It's just a feeling I have inside me of that feeling of when I was in my 30s, when I was just so insecure. So I'm not, it's not, I have to stress, it's not related to the human beings involved
at all
on any level.
But it's also not
wouldn't
with my dad,
want to
it's
go
not.
Back to that
yeah.
or anything. I've totally moved on from that, but it's just, I haven't slightly, it's very existentialist. I just haven't moved on from that.
But that's how I feel, because it's not my dad. And, you know, in a way, I didn't really know that person that well because I was only 15 when he died. And obviously, the first few years, I didn't really remember what I was doing. So it's become... That's exactly how I feel. It's not the person. Like, if you said, do you want that person back here now? I'd be like, I don't know, because I'm a completely different... Like, what would I say to them? You know, you said it's not them. It's losing someone and the way you lose them and the age you lose them. Like you said, you were in a very secure place and then two big things happened that pulled the rug, which reminds you of your, you know, childhood. So I think it's... Like you said, it's existential. It's not like... Oh, this person would come back and it would fix it. It's like, no, it's knowing that life is not stable, I think, is what it did for me. It made me go, oh, life is, you can't, I always say, it's like you're at the deep end. You go to put your foot down and you're like, oh, shit, I'm at the deep end. I thought it was in the shallow end and I can't put my foot down on the water.
Yeah.
That's how I felt a lot of the time. Like, oh, I didn't know I was at the deep end. What? I thought I was in the shallow end. And that's what that death did for me, was like, oh, life is not always quite what you think it is. And that's a hard lesson.
No, but also, you know, let's put it in massive perspective globally. You
know, of course,
life is really tricky.
Yeah, yeah.
For probably 90%. Of humanity, really tricky, like, you know, tricky in a way we're not even brushing on. So it's all, I think, what's useful about our very sort of little
pains and traumas,
which are part of being human.
Yeah,
so they're real and big to us because you can only relate to how things make you feel as a human being. But, you know, I do sort of bring myself up the whole time and think, oh, my goodness, this is not... There's bigger things out there, which, again, goes back to challenge and all those things. It's why I love doing all those projects, because it just did absolutely make you realise what was going on in the world and feel such a sort of love and empathy and for your fellow human beings, really.
It's such a balance, because I totally get, like... I always think, like, life is this huge long scale and there's always people worse off than you and there's always people better off than you. You can only sort of deal with, like you said, your pain that you need to deal with. But you're right, like, there is that other perspective of, like, I often think that, like, yeah, you know, I lost my dad. People lose, you know, especially when we have, like, we talk about the refugee crisis, people losing their entire families and, like, it's awful what some people are going to. Mm. But your pain is your pain. Because I used to have friends say that to me at school of, like, oh, well, I can't be sad, Carriad, because your dad died, like just my granddad died. And I'd be like, yeah, but you're still sad. Like, your sadness can't be negated. You can't just go, this sadness is inefficient. It must be gone. It's like, you feel it. You've got to feel it. Like, there's not, we talk about it as well, like the hierarchy of grief. It's like, there's always someone who's had more grief than you have, but that doesn't mean...
But I do think it's incumbent on us as human beings to use that and reach out to other people.
Yes.
I think I totally 100% believe in that we should be able to compartmentalise any of our own shit or whatever's going on and put it in a little drawer and move on. And even if we're just moving on in a super slightly superficial way during the day to sort of reach out to someone else... Because there's so many people out there you can reach out to. yeah, oh my God, you know, there's just such need everywhere you look, and it can just be on such a little local scale, or it can be just on this huge, massive scale.
And I loved what you said, really, that that is how you help yourself. Mm. You know, if you do feel overwhelmed by your pain, you can help other people, and that allows you to
And also,
heal.
You know, it's and you can see need and people seeking help if you're if you know those feelings.
Yeah, definitely.
Probably if you were just very glib, happy, smug person, you wouldn't even notice need.
Yeah.
You wouldn't notice it.
And I think that's true of people who haven't experienced grief. They don't. So, because sometimes I think when you're a griever, you think, oh, how did this person ignore my pain? It's like they just don't recognise it because they haven't seen it. If they're, like you said, if they haven't been through a lot, their life is fine, they, you know, they're in a very privileged financial position, then you don't see it. But yes, I think that's a really true thing, that if you have that pain, you do see it in someone
Definitely.
Else.
Definitely. You literally, it's like a heat-seeking missile. Yeah, yeah. I mean.
Well, on that note, I think you're brilliant. Thank you so much for coming to talk to me.
It's been lovely talking to you, Carriad.
Thank you. You can follow Annika on Twitter at Annika Rice and see what she's up to and her paintings, etc. She's what an incredible lady. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, or you can email thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.